Welcome to Scaling with Soul. Formerly, The Fifth Palette Almost Killed Me, a show that gives you a behind-the-scenes look at starting and growing a consumer products goods business. I'm your host, Heather K. Terry. I'm a New York City area-based consultant, and I've advised and had key roles in not only my own brands, but with dozens of others as well. My main objective is to help you avoid the many mistakes I've made or have been witness to in my 11 plus years as an entrepreneur. Let's get started. Oh my goodness, everyone. You will never believe this, but there is a man on the podcast today. It's not very often I have a man on the podcast, so it's just sort of crazy. And he is incredible. And I'm super, super pumped to introduce you to him. If you have never heard him speak or heard him drop the knowledge that he is about to drop in this podcast, because it is incredible. Solomon Choi is the founder and CEO of 16 Handles, New York City's largest frozen dessert brand with 36 locations on the East Coast. He moved to New York in 2008 from California and brings over 15 years of hospitality management and franchise development experience. He also co-founded Greeno Products in 2008, which provides custom print paper cups, containers, and plastic utensils for food service retailers. He is a seed investor and advisor to companies in the food and beverage, food technology, and online marketplace sectors. Solomon has been featured on MSN, CNBC, Bloomberg News, ABC News, Fox Business, The Wall Street Journal, and The New York Times, among many others. He is a panelist and speaker at domestic and global summits and conferences for industries that include restaurants, franchising, digital marketing and innovations, payments, technologies, and schools. He is a graduate of the Marshall School of Business at USC with a concentration in marketing. And let me tell you all, he is a genius marketer. I love everything he has to say about marketing. Again, I cannot wait. If you want to find him online, if you want to find 16 Handles online, it's www.16handles.com. Here we go with Solomon Choi.
I am so pleased to have Solomon Choi here on the podcast today. Thanks for joining us, Solomon.
Thanks for having me, Heather.
So your journey is so interesting to me. And of course, your bio that preceded us starting to chat is, it does not do you any kind of justice at all. So knowing a little bit of what I know about you, I want to talk really about how you got here, how you came to New York, how frozen yogurt became a thing, because you apprenticed with somebody in California for a while to learn the business and really understand it, right?
I did. And so I think maybe what would help is kind of going a little bit deeper on the origin story.
Yes.
So I grew up in Southern California. My father was a multi-unit franchisee of a Japanese buffet franchise. And so I had a chance to work for him in a turnaround situation with one of his locations in San Diego. And this was in 2005. I was able to go down there, turn the business around, and we sold it in about 18 months from the time that I went there. And he had told me, he said, hey, you have a knack for this. You should probably stay within food service. And so I was able to join a startup hospitality group, learned how to open up my own restaurant, as well as learned about franchising. So this is kind of the segue into frozen dessert. Is the CEO of the company at the time decided to buy the Southern California master franchise rights for a Texas-based gelato franchise. And he made me the director of franchise development. So I got paid to learn how to award and sell franchises and get them open. And in doing so, I realized quickly that we were selling the wrong product category within the frozen dessert segment. Because in 2005, in Los Angeles, Pinkberry opened its doors for the first time and really changed the trajectory of frozen dessert at that moment. And here we were in 2006, 2007, and I was trying to sell gelato franchises to people when really the market had spoken that they were interested in opening a frozen yogurt shop. And so it was one of those things where I was kind of at this crossroads, and I had to decide, you know, do I want to continue competing with the wrong product, or do I want to create a brand with, you know, using the product that people are demanding? And I chose the latter. And in doing so, and in making that determination, my parents were friends and still are very good friends with the owners of the very first seltzer pay-by-weight frozen yogurt shop. This is in Costa Mesa, California. It's called America's Cup Yogurt. Mr. and Mrs. Song, if you ever get a chance to listen to this podcast, thank you very much. And this is a shout out to you guys for allowing me to really come in and learn your business. And the trade-off there was, I said that I would come work for free if they would teach me how this business operated. And my promise in return was to never open a store near them. And that worked out perfectly because they had no aspirations of opening up additional locations. They didn't want a franchise. I actually even offered them, I said, hey, if you guys wanted to partner and, you know, essentially, you know, work together on a franchise, they didn't have any of those intentions or desires. So it worked out to everyone's benefit. And I worked there at America's Cup Yogurt for about 3 months. And this was towards the end of 2007 and into the beginning of 2008. And in doing so, really learned the ins and outs of the business, you know, having worked in and also opening, you know, Japanese restaurants that are, you know, far more complex. This was, you know, quite the opposite of that. And so I really liked the model. I thought it was a very franchisable model because even though I came from a food service background, having worked with my father, I could see that this was more retail management than it was food service. In the sense that there's no cooking, there's very little prepping. Most of the items already come ready to serve. So it's either, you know, being thawed and poured into a machine or put out into a topping bar. So the simplicity from a, you know, coming from a restaurant operator's background was this is as easy as it gets. And it's a low labor model. So all those things kind of work together. I also happen to love the fact that my father's first restaurant that I helped him with was a buffet franchise. And so I understood the importance of people wanting to have choices and personalization. But what I hated about the buffet model that I loved about this model was not only is it just as much, you know, even more so personalized and customized, but the customers pay by weight. Like they will pay what they put into their cup or into their cone, and it is a profitable model. Whereas with the buffet concept, I can tell you there were quite a few times where we certainly did not make a profit on certain, you know, individuals or groups that came in that knew how to kind of beat the system and could overeat. I mean, imagine if competitor eaters came into our buffet. I mean, it'd be a nightmare. And so I really love that about the model, and the fact that also with the buffet model, whereas I would have a staff of up to 60 people working on like a Friday or Saturday night, you know, in this self-serve frozen yogurt shop, I mean, it'd be one or two people working. And so I just saw the benefits of low labor, you know, a blended food average that meant that the business could be profitable, and just the, you know, reduction of headaches of having to deal with prepping food and cooking and doing all those things. And when I realized that that business model was something that I thought could be scalable in terms of choosing my location, you know, that's where, you know, my background is, you know, I studied marketing, you know, I'm a brand marketer by nature, I'm a branding guy. And, you know, I thought, you know, if I'm here in LA and I'm learning this business and, you know, I realize there's a seasonality to it that we're probably protected in Southern California with the mild weather that we have all year round. But if I really wanted to build this brand, turn it into a global franchise, there was only one city that I would leave LA to go to. And that's why I chose New York City. And, you know, this was in early 2008 when that decision was made. You know, kind of looking back, really interesting. 2008, not necessarily the best time to start a business in New York City. But you know what? It's one of those things where I think being an entrepreneur, seeing the glass is always being half full as opposed to half empty, has certainly been my kind of guiding star in terms of being able to, again, come at a time when, had I listened to everyone around me, you know, they would have said, don't do this, don't come here, what are you doing? You're crazy for leaving Southern California to do especially a frozen dessert concept. And for me, all I'm hearing is, New York City is going to be the gateway, and if I can win it there and become the leader in my marketplace, that opens up global doors. It has always been looked upon as a global leader when it comes to trends and in retail and in you know, when I look at brands that I, you know, respect, you know, to have a flagship in New York City definitely means something, not just as a domestic customer, but as a global customer. And just also understanding that, yes, while there's a seasonality, it's not like New Yorkers don't eat ice cream and frozen dessert either. So I just thought that the sheer scale of what New York City could do, even from a population standpoint, if you are the best at what you do, to me, that was going to be the best launch pad for success, or it'll be a quick note, which is always the next best answer. And so I chose New York City, and kind of looking back, you know, as they say, the rest is history. And I think the most interesting thing there also is I was able to raise $600,000 from my family. They believed in me. When I put together a budget, just working with Mr. Song and also seeing how much real estate costs in New York and that the expenses would be a lot higher, I felt that with $600,000, I could successfully open up one location. And so that's what I did. And in doing that, I opened in Manhattan's East Village to really attract that millennial consumer, who's my target customer, and opened up by the NYU dorms, where I felt that they would always be kind of replenishing this younger, subset of customers that I wanted to win over and ultimately use them as my brand ambassadors to build this brand. And so that's what I did. And where I first opened up, which is on 2nd Avenue between 9th and 10th Street, there were 10 other frozen dessert shops within a 4-block walking radius. And so that in itself was also something that, you know, if you ask advisors, even the gentleman, Steve Rappaport, if you listen to this, you already know the story. But my real estate agent, he was telling me, he's like, kid, do not do this. He's like, I'm born and raised in New Yorker. You do not want to open up here. Let me show you markets in Manhattan where there's no ice cream shops in 4 blocks. And I just couldn't take that risk because, again, for me, I thought if all 10 of these stores are making money, they're paying these leases, and they're in this close of a proximity to me, if I'm a New Yorker, if I'm, you know, searching online, like, where do I go to get frozen dessert? I'm going to East Village. There's just by sheer number of options, and I would imagine also by the sheer number of transactions that are happening there, there is no better place in New York City to open up if you want to be the leading brand within that frozen dessert category. And for me, it was a lot easier to do that and to try to become number one out of the 10 or 11 competitors in my mind than to quickly understand New York City real estate, traffic patterns, buying behavior of markets, and do that. There was too much stacked against me where I wouldn't learn that in a short period of time. Whereas if I can go in and I can beat these 10, that's something that I'm confident I can do because I have the how. And the where is answered by the sheer fact that, hey, there's 10 other competitors doing this and they're all coexisting. So that's what I did. And I remember asking Steve, and I said, Steve, let me ask you this. If I open up here and I can essentially, you know, beat out these other 10 as being the brand of choice within frozen dessert here in East Village, you know, would it be far-fetched to think that New Yorkers will start saying 16 Handles is the best frozen dessert shop in all of New York City? And he's like, well, yeah, but how are you going to beat all the 10? And that's exactly where I got to gain my confidence. I'm like, but yeah, that's right. I think I can because I'm going to be doing it. I have the formula. And I saw that I had a unique selling proposition that none of the competitors had.
So I just want to back you up for a really quick second because this is a great point and I want to kind of circle back to this, but I first want to go back to the fact that, you know, there's a lot. So a lot of the listeners on this podcast are people who, you know, they're maybe starting a business for the first time or they're in the first couple of years. And, you know, something you said back at the beginning, I think is really, really important just to highlight, which is, you know, there's always this fear around not having a paycheck, right? And sort of this idea of working for free and all of that. And I think you kind of hacked the system, right? So you were working in a franchise model to learn the franchise model. So I just want to point that out to the listeners here really quickly, because I think sometimes we think it's all or nothing. And when you're learning something or you're sort of grabbing intel, right? Because you think you want to start a business. I love that you did that. I love that you're like, hey, I think I'm moving in this direction. Let me learn as much as I possibly can from sort of some of the best so that I can take it with me and it'll serve me. So that's one thing. I just really want to highlight that because I do think it is an all or nothing game for a lot of people. And then the second thing I want to come back around to, which is something you were just touching on, was, you know, this competitive market. And, you know, I think there's a lot of fear there too in the competitive market about, like, oh, if I open up near somebody, or if there's too many people in this space. You know, one of the biggest pieces of advice that I got as a young entrepreneur was that there's enough room for everybody. So there is enough room for everybody. Like, there were 10 shops in the East Village selling frozen yogurt, and you sort of became the 11th. And I think that's such a great point that, like, hey, you know, I did come in to kind of do somewhat of the same thing, but I had a different approach. So I want to ask you, because I think that was so smart of you, right, to say, okay, there are 10 people here. I'm not going to go analyze the traffic patterns and where another frozen yogurt shop could fit in Manhattan, because I know it's working right here. How do I rise to the top of that pile? So can you tell us a little bit about what that process was like for you? Because I know that branding and consumer experience are two things you're extremely passionate about. So I'd love for you to expand on that, because I think that is what really set you apart from everybody else. So talk about that a little bit.
Sure. So I completely agree with everything that you just said. And if I can kind of go back to that moment where I decided to open up in East Village, it was absolutely that. Just like you had mentioned, I knew it was a market that worked if you had, you know, if you had the type of product they were looking for. So in this case, you know, East Village had already spoken and said, yes, we welcome and want frozen dessert. And so then really my job became, so how do I outmaneuver the competition to have, you know, a unique selling proposition that sets me apart from everybody else? Because I didn't want to be just number 11. I actually wanted to be number one out of 11. And so in order to do that, a couple things came to mind. So one, I wanted to create an experience that people would find, I wanted to create essentially that retail experience that people would want to come back to over and over again. And you can do that by providing the best level of service, which, you know, I think we did a great job at that, but I don't think it was just that. I think it was the operating model itself, in that, you know, our business, it's self-serve, it's pay by weight, it's less transactional as much as it is experiential. So especially knowing what I know now 12 years later and seeing how experiential retail is really how all retailers are focused, regardless of what you're selling. In that regard, I knew that going into the mindset of what does my customer want? What does she want? And I say she because 70% of our customer base is female. So it's really that female millennial consumer. That's my target consumer. And for me, it was really, again, this place where she had options. You know, and she had flexibility, meaning, hey, if you're on a health kick and you want to, you know, limit your sugar intake and you want to do fresh fruit and whatever it is, like, we were that place that had something for everyone in different occasions. And I think we did that better than everybody else. A, by the design, right? Because we had 16 flavors on tap that were self-serve, 50 different toppings that you can mix, match, and do whatever you want. So there was a design component. I think B, by having this inclusivity when it came to the type of different products that we had. So what I mean by that is, yes, we had, which at the time everybody knew, the pink berry tart yogurt. Right. And so I remember in the beginning, a lot of people coming in and she would say, hey, do you guys have like that pink berry tart style yogurt? Yes, we do. As a matter of fact, we have three different versions of that. And so I had that covered, which immediately then, you know, gave me not just an alternative, but an entryway to trying other things that I knew that pink berry didn't have. You know, I'm lactose. Do you have non-dairy? Yes, we do. There's a machine over there that says non-dairy. There's two flavors that will always be non-dairy. Well, you know, do you have the no sugar added? Yes, we do. And then really for the majority, and this is what I find really interesting, and I know Heather offline, we've talked about this, even in person, is really this idea of having a more flexitarian approach to how you want to eat at that moment in time. So whether it's the New Year's resolution, whether it's something you want to do on Mondays, whether it's a month you want to take off and try something different, I think that's the benefit that this retail model was really allowing her to navigate through, hey, you know what? I just took my final. I'm going to let loose and I'm going to overindulge. Cool. 16 handles, you're my go-to. Hey, you know what? you know, I'm doing yoga and I want to treat myself to something, but I don't want to totally kill my workout. Great, 16 handles, you're there for me. To, hey, you know what? You know, I'm meeting up on a first date, right? And that's like a safe place that I can go where it's not expensive and I know I can get something that I like. I mean, really when it comes to those occasions in life, I think that 16 handles is mm-hmm. the best job out of the 10 that are there to allow her to, again, flex one way or the other, whether it's dietary, whether it's like an occasion, whether it's social. I mean, you know, I think all of those things we did better than everybody else. And so, yes, I think that became then the kind of unique, calling that 16 handles had over other frozen dessert shops that are in the area.
So this is the thing I actually find the most fascinating about you as an entrepreneur, because until I met you and sat down with you, I think I was trying to say this to a lot of my clients in a way that wasn't really super clear. And when I sat down with you a couple of weeks ago, Solomon, it all kind of clicked together. And, you know, for you as a man to have a target consumer as a millennial woman, one of the things I find the most fascinating about you is that, like, obviously you're not a female millennial who started this business, and you have really taken a great amount of time and great pains to get in the head of your target consumer. You know, I think a lot of entrepreneurs will target a consumer and maybe read something about them or collect some data about them. And that's really important, I think, or, you know, build an avatar. And I think all those things are really, really, really important. But when we were talking recently, one of the things you kept coming back to was like, I will assemble a room full of my target customer and I will just listen to her and I will ask her a million questions and she leads me to the answer, right? And I can't, you know, express how important I think that is. And I want you to talk a little bit about your experiences in doing that.
Absolutely. So I think in looking back and especially early on, I'm trying to understand, okay, well, what were some of your success metrics? And not from a results standpoint, but like you said, like what did you actually do that set you apart to be able to do that? I think the thing that hasn't changed, because we can look at the store and I think stylistically, you know, we've rebranded, our logo's changed, the in-store decor has changed. But the one thing that hasn't changed is really the fanaticism of being able to understand who is she? Because also, this is something that I remember, and I'll give you the example, I think I shared this with you, is who she was in 2008 walking into my doors as an NYU freshman is very different now as a millennial mom of two living in the Upper East Side and now taking her kids generationally. And I think I shared the story with you, but that to me was another aha moment where when she was young, she's the one who helped me create a Facebook page. Right? I didn't grow up with Facebook. I didn't have that. I didn't have an account. So even understanding, like, how did you communicate? Now, I can get that from working in my store 7 days a week, and that's exactly what I did when I first opened. And how do you communicate? How do you tell your friends to come here, right? So even just from that standpoint, not assuming that, well, you know, you probably send an email or you probably saw an ad, which again, as a marketer, sometimes we get caught up in that is, okay, well, what are our paid versus owned channels and what can we spend more on? But really just literally asking her, because for some reason, she came into my doors and she transacted with me and she's either happy or she's not. Most of the time she was happy. So to me, it's really getting, kind of looking in between the lines of like, so what drove you to that? What were the channels that got you there? And then what do I need to be doing better? So that way you're going to tell all of your friends. So that way it not only keeps you coming back, but that you can then become a brand evangelist. And this was, you know, before the days of, you know, social media influencer marketing. And so it was really about, okay, what she likes or doesn't like, I need to be there and to get the pulse. Sure, while it may not be scalable in terms of always being there for every single one of her responses, for me in the beginning, that's exactly what I did. And then while I was scaling and I became a franchise, again, it really just came back to her. There were times within our brand progression and growth that we kind of lost our way. What I mean by that is we started thinking, well, okay, we're in suburban communities now, so we need to focus on the kids as being the main driver. Or, you know, in Boca Raton, Florida, where, hey, we have seniors and retirees, and they don't necessarily like the way that we do that marketing. They want these types of flavors. And when we did that, it really stretched us. And it wasn't until we decided, you know what, let's go back to our core. You know what, because that's also what got us into those markets. we didn't get into those communities because we started talking to people that ended up, you know what I mean? Like, it wasn't after the fact that we said, hey, oh yeah, we knew that in going to Boca, we need to also stretch older and have a brand voice that was safer. It wasn't about that. So when we try to be reactive, that's when we started, you know, tripping over our own progression. And it was when we went back to, hey, this is what made us us. This is what makes her love us and love our brand. So if we stick with that, then the other things will follow. And guess what? If we happen to go to a market where that's not the case, because she doesn't exist there, then we shouldn't have opened there in the first place. That was a site selection challenge, not a, hey, but because this market happens to be like this, like we should change. Because I think with brands, right, to me, the definition of a brand is how strong of a positive emotional connection you have with your guests. And if they don't love you, then, you know, then it becomes much more transactional, which then brings you down to, well, you're a store or you're servicing a product. And for me, it was all about building a brand. So, you know, understanding her, you had mentioned it, you know, I hold a lot of different focus groups, some of them formal, some of them informal. And to me, just when I'm sitting in a room full of her, it just opens my eyes. And because, like you mentioned, I'm not her, I actually have what I think is more of an unfair advantage, because if I were that millennial female, then I know my kind of predispositions and my thoughts, and then I'll probably make a lot more assumptions just because, well, I know that this is how it would be marketed to me, or I know that I like this flavor and my friends like this flavor. So our subset groups then dictate what all millennial females like. And look, it's not to say that Pixie Handles understands what all millennial females like, but because I get different data points of tons of millennial female, and I will never be one, to me, I'm a lot more open to, you know, trying to understand her. And again, go with her on her journey. That's the other piece, which I think, to me, I don't have that blind spot, because if she's telling me and a group of them are telling me that, hey, we're now looking at this, or hey, here's why we go to you after our yoga or spin cycle class, right? I remember having a group and asking them that, because this was at a time when really like SoulCycle was really booming throughout the city. And I noticed that there were a lot of females going to SoulCycle and then, you know, Instagramming or putting on Facebook their picture of treating themselves after. And that wasn't a campaign that we started, but I started seeing that. And so when I started seeing that, that's when I realized I need to learn this behavior, because I didn't promote it. I never even, you know, it's not even something that I would have known to do. And so when I held a focus group at the office, for one, I mean, that's the other thing, is I think that the fact that we're such an approachable brand and an approachable store environment, I think it certainly helps. And so when I'm holding these things, then it's literally, hey, talk to the CEO and founder, and because we really want to make this a better brand. It's very different than like what a lot of other brands will say, which is, hey, we care about what our customers think, and not saying that they don't, but kind of, so what is the founder, CEO, the ultimate decision maker actually doing? I think that that's a good, you know, a good metric on how much do they really care. Like, you know, I'm not saying that the other ones don't, but, you know, are they really where their customers are at? And so, you know, to me, when I did that and I had that that group, A, they all, I kind of go, so why did you guys all show up on like a, let's call it a Wednesday afternoon after work? And they're like, well, one, we love the brand. Two, the fact that you invited us, right, said that it was going to be a panel, not a panel, but it was going to be a discussion with you and only you. Like, who does that, right? Most of the brands wouldn't allow us to have that kind of access. And yeah, and so just in doing that, I realized, cool, so she wants to be heard, but she doesn't have enough outlets for her truly to feel that she is heard, right? And so again, while you can kind of argue the other side and say, yeah, but how scalable is that? You can't sit there and have focus groups all day long. Right, but the fact that you're trying, I think, shows. And if you can, you know, get some, if you can get some nuggets and some truths out of those meetings, as sparse as they may be, it's going to be a lot better than, again, sitting in front of a computer, reading a few articles and thinking that, hey, well, this is what I think that they want because this is what I'm reading.
Yeah. And I think you bring up a really great point. And I actually just want to talk about this for a really quick second, but you know, when you are your customer, right. And you are, look, that's great when we're founders and we've highlighted a problem because we're experiencing the problem. But I think you're right. I do think that you're lucky in the sense that you're removed from who your customer is because you have so much more insight into looking at the whole picture. Whereas sometimes I think founders can say, oh, well, I know because this is my problem and I go through this every day. I think that makes it even more important to sit down with your target customer because it's exactly what you said, by making those assumptions, you might be doing something, you know, I was just writing a bunch of stuff with some of my writers for my website. And we were saying like, okay, you like it, your husband likes it, but does your customer like it? You know, because you're in your own little private ecosystem. It's sort of, you know, you've got your blinders on to what is right for you, but is it right for the customer? Are they responding to it just because you think they're responding to it, because you think you're your core consumer, doesn't necessarily mean that they are responding to it. So you've got to really be able to open yourself up as a founder or a CEO, right, to figure out if they're enjoying the experience. I think another thing that you brought, that I was just thinking of as you were talking, was this idea that, you know, everybody wants to go after the millennial market, right? And you were talking about how this millennial customer has changed over the last 10 years, right? And, you know, I see a lot of data as a marketer myself, as a sales and marketing person myself, I see a lot of data about millennials that is just regurgitated information about millennials. And, you know, this group that everyone is still so desperately trying to target, they have changed over the years. And I think we have to be really, really smart as founders, sales teams, marketing teams about reaching them where they are at any given moment, because it does evolve over time. So thank you for highlighting that.
And my pleasure. And again, I think, you know, having a commitment to that goal is what we've done, I think, better and outmaneuvered better than our competitors, you know, to get us to this spot. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's not something that will ever change, because I think it's part of our brand pillar is, you know, is to make sure that she loves us and loves this brand. And, you know, one of the stories, again, you know, that I alluded to was, I remember seeing and interacting with a customer in my Upper East Side location, again, years later. And she goes, I remember you, you're the owner, you're the founder. And I was like, oh yeah, like you must have seen me in East Village. She goes, yeah, I was an NYU student. And I lived in the dorms nearby. And yeah, I'd go there all the time. And she was there with her 2-year-old son. You know, she was like holding him up so he could pull down the handle. And I just thought like that moment really encapsulated everything that, you know, I came out to New York City to do, which was like create and build this brand that people will love. And then for her to be my brand advocate, and then for her to share now with the next generation, in this case, her son, for this to be something that he loves. Mm. And he's certainly not a millennial, nor is he a female. But I believe that through the passion that she has and that, again, that brand connection I built with her, that she's now going to continue advocating and making this a place that her family will come to. And so being able to see that even one generation in a short period of time, to me, like I said, was just so powerful. And even in talking to her, right? So I asked her, I was like, cool. So I noticed, like, you know, you're getting him, like, you know, you're trying to tell him, like, you know, that he needs to portion control. And that, you know, I saw her as she, like, walked through and down the talking line. She's like, well, I'm only going to give you 2 gummy bears and this, that, and the other. And so I asked her, I was like, hey, so this is clearly very different than how you came into my store, you know, call it 7 years prior as a college student. And she's like, oh, absolutely. But she goes, now I care about what he's eating and I'm a lot more sensitive about that. And so, you know, so I asked her, so what could we do better? Like, what would make you want to come here more with your son? You know, she was saying, like, you know, a lot of the toppings I see, like, you know, they're all filled with sugar, and I get that kids love it. My kids no different. But it's very hard for me to limit them in a self-serve setting where it's like, you know, they're seeing like all the treats, and that's what they want. They don't want the healthy granola and the fresh fruit. Like, they want the gummy bears, the fudge, and like the rainbow sprinkles. And so she was like, if there were options that were, again, healthier than kind of what's out there, that would be nice. You know, she was saying things like, you know, I want to limit the sugar intake that he has. And so those types of data points ultimately, you know, did fall on deaf ears. And even for our product development, you know, so one of the things we did, you know, I shared this with you, is for all of 2019, all of our monthly new flavors were vegan soft serve. And so it wasn't about whether it was ice cream, yogurt, or, you know, some of the other dairy alternatives that we had. It was seeing, as I also, you know, visit a lot of these, you know, food shows around the country, that I'm seeing this trend that she's looking for more, you know, plant-based or dairy-free options. And again, one could look at that and be like, well, is everyone turning vegan in New York? No, I don't think that that's the case. And that's not the why. The why is, again, if we are about inclusion, And she is going to go through this journey where her friend, her kid, her spouse, her roommate, her coworker, you know, may have a proclivity towards this. Then the only way to be inclusive is if we have more options. So it was that next year, and right. Kind of giving a preview here on your show, all of our flavors are going to be able to tout the low carb, no sugar, or like 1 gram of sugar per serving. And so again, really being able to adapt and adopt to the various lifestyles and what we've also been hearing over the years, which is your products are amazing. But you know, for some of them, I feel guilty, whether it's myself or for my kids, I want to limit their sugar intake, or hey, I'm on this type of a diet and I have to eliminate carbs or sugar. Being there as like not the bad guy, or hey, I don't want 16 handles to ever go from, hey, I used to go to you all the time, and now you're my cheat day. I want to be there with you all the time, where that's fine if you're your cheat day, but you don't need to only be your cheat day. Like, let us be the place where you go to make yourself happier, because we are going to accommodate and flex as much as we can to accommodate whatever situation you're in, dietary or otherwise. And so again, that level of commitment, and again, the reason I wanted to bring up that generational story was that's really the first time it also opened my eyes that not just more of, hey, just keep it the same, don't change, and my kid's going to love it. It's, hey, she is probably going to bring her son into our store over the years, but there's more that I could be doing. There's more that Brian could be offering to make that just a little bit easier and with less friction.
I love it. No, look, I could sit here and talk to you all day. You know that. You and I sat forever the last time we saw each other, just kind of shooting it back and forth. It was amazing. And but we're going to wrap up. You're such an amazing marketer and I am founder, and just your story is so inspiring. Is there anything you want to leave the listeners with? Is there anything that you just like, I want you to take away this one thing, like, don't forget this one thing?
Yes, and actually you kind of alluded to it before, which is I also, you know, talk to a lot of startup founders and entrepreneurs and entrepreneurs, people who want to be an entrepreneur, and there tends to be this overemphasis on two things. So it's kind of a two-part. One is, okay, like I'm ready to hustle, I'm ready to kind of roll up my sleeves, do whatever I need to do. But there seems to be an overemphasis on fundraising as the only way to be able to get from this idea that I have to success. And I think too much of a KPI is put on how much did you raise, right? I go to a lot of networking events, with a lot of startup founders, and that seems to be the badge of honor. It's like, cool, I just raised this much, or I'm going to this round. And, you know, to me, I would say, hey, maybe I'm old school, but, you know, focus on profitability, because that's going to give you the longest runway than any investor will. And then you're also able to kind of shield against, you know, changing trends or what have you. You're able to pivot. So I would say that. And then the second piece to that is really put in the work, not to just work hard, but work smarter. So I'm glad that you pointed that out, but that's something that I can't take away, is that I put in my dues, not so much, hey, I have this idea and I'm going full force with it, but I put in my dues before that. So it actually helped alleviate a lot of the pain that I had going into it, right? And so, you know, when I was working for free for 3 months, that's because I had the luxury of being able to do that, but I didn't have any pressures at that point. You know, I moved back home, you know, so that's something I had to do. So sure, I just fall on my fight a little bit, but I made my lifestyle and put myself in a position where it wasn't such a sacrifice. I didn't have to worry about investors or, you know, anything at that time. It was really, I'm going to invest into myself. I'm going to learn how to do this. And that way, when I'm ready, I mean, that's why my family were the first ones to step up to the bat. They're like, you know how to do this. You have a proven track record and you've worked and you've mastered this thing. We want to take a bet on you. And so to me, you know, while that may not be, you know, the narrative that everybody has, like, that's what worked for me. And it was because I took the time to really know and learn what it is that I thought I was going to do. And then to identify, how would I have known also going in, moving to New York, that it was going to be the same customer, that millennial female? Well, working there for 3 months and seeing that this product category was resonating with her, it was something that I wouldn't have known otherwise. It would have been a guess, or I'd have to read a report. But having interacted with her for 3 months, granted it was in the West Coast, it made it very easy for me to understand that's what I should expect in the East Coast, and it was. And so I dove then, right, you know, I dove deeper into understanding her more and the lifestyle in the Northeast as opposed to the West Coast. So it was really more focusing on those things than kind of starting from scratch, the money's burning, I have to worry about my run rate. Like, it was, you know, I already made the investment in sacrifice, And now it's really about execution and understanding her today, tomorrow, and forever.
I love it. Well, thank you. So I could, like I said, I could talk to you all day. You know that. You and I could sit for hours and just unpack all of this stuff. And maybe we'll have to have you come on again to talk about investments and profitability and all that stuff, because I am of a similar mindset to you. But thank you so much, Solomon, for coming on to the podcast. We really appreciate it.
My pleasure, Heather. Thanks so much for having me.
All right.
A brave and brilliant man. Solomon, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. He was so incredible, right? And it's always nice to hear a new perspective, and it's always fun to have a guy on the podcast. So thanks for coming on, Solomon. I know you'll be listening to this episode, and I hope you'll come on again, because I think there's so much more we could have talked about. I think Solomon Choi and I could probably talk just about marketing. We could probably just talk for like a week straight. I mean, we'd need to get food and water, but you know, it is what it is. Anyway, remember, Scaling with Soul comes out as often as we can produce it. For more startup business insights, sign up for my newsletter at heatherkterry.com or buy my book, From Broadway to Wall Street, Cautionary Tales of an Unlikely Entrepreneur, which is available on Amazon. If you have an idea or question for the podcast, direct message me on Instagram at heatherkterry. Make sure you are subscribed to the podcast on iTunes. And if you feel compelled to leave a comment, they really, really help, and we really, really appreciate them. If you'd like to work with me directly, go over to the website and click on the offerings tab. You can contact us there to set up some time. Scaling with Soul is executive produced by Lauren Appelt, and all visual elements are created by Radhika Maheshwari, Casey Alvarez, and the Alvarez Branding Company. Now, get out there and do something to move your business forward, as always. Till next time.